And so when you're ready to centrally bring those together to find a repeatable, sustainable solution for healthy revenue, that's when revenue operations comes in. And that can be the force multiplier of your revenue growth.
Welcome to the OpStars podcast, where we talk to revenue operations pros at the top of their game so that we can collectively support each other through the sharing of ideas, learning best practices, and discovering innovative new strategies. I'm your host, Don Afos.
Thank you for joining us on the OpStars podcast. Today, I have with us Laura Wheeler. Laura Wheeler is a solopreneur at the moment, running Renegade Operations in a fractional role. And prior to that, you really cut your teeth at which company, Laura?
At Tableau Software.
That's great. But to the point, a lot of what I talk about is the fact that people, you know, they never graduate college thinking they want to go into RevOps, right? That's always some of the thing they're coming in of. And you were a mass communications major. So I would love for you to tell us, can you share your journey from majoring in mass communications to becoming a leader in sales and then eventually moving into RevOps? What drove those transitions for you?
Yeah, definitely completely opposite from where I'm at right now. However, there is a potential steel thread there. When I graduated college, obviously mass communication at the time had the umbrella of film, and I actually minored in film. So after I graduated, I moved to Austin, Texas, and was an intern for Richard Linklater for free, which was very, very cool. I thought that I wanted to do like film cinematography and go into that field. So very different from RevOps. That obviously does not pay anything. You know, you have to really grind your teeth in that business as well.
Yeah.
Time I was obviously waiting tables. And I had done that all throughout college. It's funny because I actually, there was an event that was at this company and I was waiting tables. I was kind of like the head person there, and they were in tech. And they came up to me afterwards and said, hey, I really like the way that you aligned with us as stakeholders and you took care of us. And there was a lot of prep work. We're actually looking for someone to be in sales. I think you would be really great at this. I said, what does it pay? And it was three times more than I was making. And I said, you got it. So I actually really did stumble into a sales career. And at that time, I was right. Since I was living in Austin, I was a manufacturer's rep to Dell. So I was selling a lot of things.
Oh, wow.
Dell, where I learned the nitty gritty about distribution and OEM, and just I was hammering the phones. From there, I learned a lot, but obviously I wanted to spread my wings and move to a new city. So I moved to Seattle, and one of my former buyers had worked at a Fortune 50 company in Seattle. It's headquartered there.
Okay.
And I reached out and said, hey, can you get me a job? Like, I'll do anything at this point. And he said, you don't want to work here, but you should check out this startup called Tableau. And this was 2013. I said, you know what?
Yeah, I was going to say, this like Tableau was like small. I mean, they were not a big company.
Yeah. Headquartered in Fremont. I said, you know what? Yeah, I'll do it. And interviewed, started as an inside sales rep, which was full sales cycle like BDR. So I was supporting four outside reps. And from there, I spent 9 years at Tableau. It was absolute joy, but it was crazy. I mean, talk about major hyper growth. When I joined the entire company, it was a perpetual business, wasn't even SaaS. And we were about like 250 million. I was employee number 600. And when I ended my career there, every single year I was promoted into a new role. I had three different types of roles there, through leadership, went into operations, enablement, then owning it all, and eventually then leaving there for a startup and taking what I knew into that startup world. So it has been a major journey. But I also want to caveat that I didn't start at Tableau and really my tech career until I was 30. And I know a lot of people out there are thinking like, hey, I'm 25. They're grinding in the tech world and kind of stressed out that they're not either moving up or moving forward. And like, there's still time to enter the tech world, potentially in a later stage. So I just want to throw that out there because a lot of people kind of resonate with that now.
That's so true. I think a lot of the folks that we have on the podcast, you know, they're all very much mid-career transitions into RevOps. And there's such great stories. And it's why I love highlighting folks like you on the podcast, because it's like anybody can do this. It's like, here's some stories of what you can do. The other thing I would point out with your journey is the reasons why you moved into the roles you did weren't because you applied. It was because somebody either recognized something in you and then wanted to bring you into what they were doing, or you had that relationship already and they were wanting to move you into that role. So a lot of times, if someone wanted to make a mid-career transition, it isn't a matter of like going to apply for jobs when you're entry-level RevOps and you don't know anybody there. You should really look at like, who do I know? Like, what does my LinkedIn look like? And then leverage that to be like, hey, you're at this company or you're in this role and I kind of want to head in this direction of my career. Are there areas that you think I could move into? Or is there something I could do where you're working today where I could take on that role? 8 years at Tableau, that's crazy. I mean, you saw Tableau really blow up.
Yeah.
From being that kind of relatively new startup into being an acquisition of Salesforce.
Yeah, the two things there is, when I started at Tableau, I kind of took a step a little back from the starting position that I was in. And a lot of people are scared to do that because they think, I don't want to take a step back. I want to take a step forward. And I think this is a common theme that's going to be throughout this podcast. But sometimes you have to take a step back to move multiple steps forward. And that really helped the trajectory of my career. You know, was I overqualified? Probably not, but maybe. But that really then solidified. I came in really knowing some things over a lot of other people that were on my team because I'd already done it before, but I just wanted the job. I wanted to be there. And so it really did actually help my career. And then they always say you do your future role as you're doing it. And that's the beauty of a startup. You can raise your hand and say, yeah, I'll do this. I see this gap in the company. Let me just go ahead and like add it to my current role. And a lot of people are scared to potentially take on extra work, but sometimes it really does pay off, especially in the startup world.
Yeah.
We need as much help as we can get.
No, that's very true. So while you were inside sales leader at Tableau, I mean, that must have been a great, it seems like you were printing money, right? Like, but like, how did your approach to sales leadership contribute to that team's success? Like, what were some of the things that you'd implemented?
Yeah, well, I would like to think that we were printing money, but I was selling into the public sector. So,
ooh.
Yeah. So for all my public sector people out there, you know how this feels. And we were a very small startup. Like they had just started investing in this, you know, quote unquote vertical. And when I say investing, like putting people before like any sort of process. And so as an inside sales leader there, obviously as a leader, you take an immense empathy and ownership of making sure that your people are hitting their numbers. And in a traditional model, as a sales leader, I wasn't a part of making quotas yet. And that was being done from the top down. And if you know anything about the public sector, there is a seasonality to it. There is a thing called election years, and you need specific lead routing, you need specific partners, you need specific processes, but none of that was being thought through from the top down. And so I was really trying to protect my inside sellers from our leads going to other teams, which I developed relationships with all of the other commercial leaders to make sure that we were all swimming in the right lanes. Because the last thing that I wanted to do was create conflict between reps internally. And we were hiring so fast and quotas were just being, you know, divvied out that it was another area where I wanted to take a step back and say, what can I do as a leader to help protect my people and actually get them to make money? So if I can't influence the process that's coming top down, then I'm going to do whatever I can to get these people enough to eat to get to their quota. And so from there, I think that's where it dovetailed into maybe I need to think more operationally about this and start taking it up the flagpole. And as the quantitative things that were coming out, they needed to know what was happening, because if we missed a quarter, that would not be good. And like we were on this growth path. So I'd like to say that we were printing money, but it was really, really difficult to grow that vertical without the awareness from top down and or any sort of processes or operational excellence there.
Yeah. I mean, and you even ended up as the chief of staff for the public service vertical.
Yeah.
As part of that whole, like, I want to do more, you know, I want to be involved in the planning. But you mentioned when you moved into that role, you didn't really know what to call it initially.
Yeah.
And like, you see people called chief of staff and it's like, you look at it and like, well, what is your job? Like, what do you do?
Yeah.
So like, how did you navigate and define what that role was being such a new and undefined space?
Yeah. I think initially I had built a lot of respect and relationships internally with many different parts of leadership And I started to take some of these bigger issues up the flagpole and just saying, hey, I think we need to invest in these types of partners. I think we need to educate our partners because they are an extension of our sales team. It was most of our revenue in the public sector flowed through partners. So they needed to be just as apt to talk about our product. And we had zero partner enablement. So that's like one example. When we would go do field events, it was totally different. In the public sector, you have to pay to play. And so while they were dialing back field marketing resources on the commercial side, I said, well, we absolutely need to be at these events because this is where we actually do generate leads. And so from there, what we started to see was like these special projects kind of popping up where we had a term, well, the whole public sector had a term. We were about 150 people at this time. Oh, Wheels will fix it. You know, my last name's Wheeler, so that's my nickname. And so it started to be this like joke, like there would be a problem that presented and they're like, oh, Wheels, you got it though. Like you'll figure it out. So I kind of became that problem solver on the team. And it got to a point where it was really not taking over my job, but I was working a lot. I was managing a team of about 32 inside sales reps. I had leaders and then also taking on these additional projects. And my SVP got tapped in to go to like head the entire public sector as we were building out state and local and government. And he said, I really, really need someone to be like my right-hand person. I need someone to basically, as he would coin it, to make sure I'm not like running towards a cliff. And that's where we kind of put together this job description. I said, I would love to be that person. I'm already doing half of that role. Let's hire my backfill and let's call it, I don't know. And we kind of circulated internally. We didn't have sales operations. We didn't have that. It was only business operations under finance. It was me and another person who were kind of screaming from the bottom up. And we both became chief of staff. That's what we landed on. She was on another side on the private sector and I was on the public sector side. And that's really where I would say sales operations was born at Tableau through those two channels. Because it was the bridge between the tops down and the bottoms up. It was time for them to invest in that. And by that time, we were a $650 million business as a whole and going through monumental change into SaaS, reorging internally. So it was an exciting time. But yeah, chief of staff, I think that's still a thing, you know, handling special projects.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you see it pop up on LinkedIn every once in a while. And sometimes I look at it. I think everybody defines it differently, but it's great to hear the story of like how it evolved at Tableau, right? I mean, like chief of staff is what was the genesis of revenue operations at Tableau as a company.
Yeah, and it was very exciting.
So you also empathized the importance of asking for a seat at the table during planning. Can you talk about some of the strategies you used to earn that seat and how others might replicate that if they're looking for that same like, hey, I need to be a part of the planning process if you want this to work in a situation.
Yeah. And I think asking for a seat at the table is a very delicate balance between people, humans, insights, some of the things that we've been talking about, these kind of qualitative things that have been coming up in these projects that we've been working on. Oftentimes, trying to ask for a seat at the table, we're kind of far away from the data. Like, luckily, I worked for a data company, but at the same time, I don't think I had visibility into like our major metrics that we were trying to track. Like I had said before, there's this kind of internal influence mapping that I like to say, we ask our SDRs and our AEs to do this all the time. So if you're going into an account, who are the people? What are their roles? But also how are they influenced within the organization to basically get stuff done? You know, obviously you're looking for a signer. And I would say it's no different than trying to advocate internally for yourself or ask for a seat at the table. You need to understand who is at the table and the influence that they have across the business. Luckily, I had an incredible mentor and leader that really believed in me. He was my outside salesperson. We, you know, went into the chief of staff and SVP together, and he had the seat at the table. And when we were talking about career development conversations, I said, listen, I don't understand sometimes why people are making these decisions internally. And I would love to understand how you all are getting to these decisions. And this is how equity is coming to the team. We were a public company at the time, and I wanted to understand how you distribute equity and why is that fair? And how do you decide on headcount? And these were more of the true revenue operations, annual planning, inputs. And I said, I want a part of that. I had a natural curiosity to make sure that, you know, we are taking care of our people on the front lines, but also strategically taking care of our people. And so, you know, I had him basically advocate for me to have a seat at the table. And so I would attend meetings with him and really try to soak up everything that I could. And he was incredible to give that open door visibility into that. And I think that's one, making sure that you do map out your influence and your people. You want people to speak your name in meetings when you are not there. And then you also need a list of all of your qualitative insights. So when it is your turn to either have that seat at the table, talk at the seat of the table, you have those. Here are the three or four things that I'm seeing, and you're bringing value. And so for me, that's kind of what worked. But we were also in hyper growth and a lot of things were happening. So they were happy to help kind of bring people up and have that seat at the table.
Yeah, that's awesome. I know that the rapid growth of quote unquote traditional RevOps, the absence of it at some companies, you know, particularly at Tableau, at one point in your career really led you to fix the processes and educate partners internally and externally. Can you share what some of the challenges were that you faced during this transformation and how you overcame them?
Yeah. With every sort of change, there's some sort of either human investment or monetary investment. And your own human investment in it, which is your time, your other individual's time and alignment, can only go so far. And so you're going to have to ask for money. And that's when having a seat at the table really does help. There were some really big headwinds in some of the investments we wanted to make. You know, I was taking on partner enablement. I didn't really know what I was doing. I just knew I was trying to solve a problem. And so when I took a step back and said, listen, these are all the things that I am doing, and this is the impact that it's having on the business, and having some sort of dossier of that, going to the table and asking for investments, initially they were shut down. And one in particular is compliances. So when you're selling into a public sector or of healthcare or something, you do have to pay to play. And so we didn't have our FedRAMP, and that basically took our serviceable addressable market, which I did not know that term at the time, more narrow. But our quotas were still saying as large.
So when you say that investment, you said it was FedRAMP?
Yeah, FedRAMP. So it's a compliance that basically is a check in the box to sell into the federal government. And you can't even get into the door if you do not have that check in the box. So when you think about your like serviceable addressable market, the federal government is massive. They probably have the largest budget to capture. But if we don't have the right compliance or front end certifications, we can't even get foot in the door. But getting FedRAMP is very expensive. And so they said, okay, well, how much business are you losing? And I'm like, well, we don't really know. So we started to track it. I said, here are all the deals that we're losing because we are not FedRAMP, and or we needed to change our process. We couldn't even have those types of conversations with specific government agencies because we just did not have that, or cleared reps. They're very expensive to hire. They're like, well, why do you need that? Well, let me just tell you. So I think there were a lot of like, oh, you want this? No, prove it to me. And so you'd have to go back to the table, and you can't, you know, as an operator or someone that's asking for something, you can't take the first no, similar to sales. And you say, okay, well, let me just track this and bring it to the table. But there were a lot of business cases that my SVP and I had to create and quantify before even getting the investment. But I think that's why Tableau was really successful, because they were very cognizant of that and they wanted to make sure that they were investing in the right things.
They moved quickly to do it too.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Once we proved it. But it is a lot of work to put together a business case internally for something. And it's a natural barrier, but you have to do it. And that continues. And I think it's even gotten harder over the last 2 years. You know, we used to be able to just buy software or hire people. But now scrutiny has come in the business, and we need to make sure that the investments that we are making, especially in startups, are the right investments.
Yeah. You talked about the surprise need for revenue operations and organizations. And I've seen this myself, where it's like, well, do we need RevOps? Is it time? Like, are we too soon? Are we too late? Like, what are the signs that companies should look for to know that it's really time to invest in RevOps?
Yeah, it is different at every company. You know, I've kind of adapted the answer to this question from one of my colleagues, Wayne Morris, and he has this four stages of scalable go-to-market growth. First one is idea market fit. So we have this idea, we know we can sell into it. We know our ICP, we're just going to go. Like, we are agile, we're scrappy. We know that there's a need out there. Then you start to move into the product market fit. Okay, well, how are we realizing value? How are we proving value? We have beta customers. We do have customers. And that's usually around like the 2 to 5 million. You're starting to see, okay, well, this is a proven, like, there is a fit here. And then people just want to jump to scale because they're like, well, we have it. And I think that's often where you create this thing called go-to-market debt. And so you scale too fast, you hire leaders, you're like, let's put some people on it before actually bringing together operationally the KPIs and metrics of where you're needing to go and really doing it right from the beginning. So decisions deeply rooted in data. I would say over the last 4 years, people have moved so quickly that there is a ton of go-to-market debt. And you've seen that with the recent, you know, layoffs. Oh my gosh, we hired too many people, or we were making investments in areas that we really wanted to, like partners or maybe an acquisition. And it's like, oh my gosh, we need to go back to make sure that we are continuing to have product market fit. Then we go to go-to-market fit, which is finding that repeatability and that scalability to then take off. And so I think RevOps comes in from a basic foundational. You should have some sort of operational excellence from the beginning, whether you're doing data capture, data monitoring, but you're not really going to know what's happening in the business until stuff actually happens. And so for me, a RevOps hire or a fractional hire can come in and really make an impact from that, oops, we grew too fast. Maybe it's even like 70 million. But the sweet spot for me is 5 million to 70 million. We are trying to optimize. We are going back to basics. We are centralizing our operations because more than likely, operations is fractionally sitting with heads of sales or BDR manager, or I have MOPS, but I don't have, you know, CS ops. And so when you're ready to centrally bring those together to find a repeatable, sustainable solution for healthy revenue, that's when revenue operations comes in. And that can be the force multiplier of your revenue growth.
Yeah. I mean, my argument is, like, you should almost think about hiring RevOps before you even hire a sales team. Bring somebody on to build out all those processes first. Get your CRM, get your tech stack architected the way you want before you start even putting any material into it. And for a RevOps person, that's like nirvana, right? Like, to be able to have the opportunity to do that, that's like the golden opportunity, because it's like, wow, I can build everything from scratch and I don't have to clean up somebody's mess. This is amazing, right?
I do like cleaning up mess, but I mean, ultimately, if you can have that operational excellence from the beginning, from those early stages, then your go-to-market debt is going to be super small and then you can excel. But so often it is like, oh my gosh, I woke up and we've got all these sales. Congratulations. We just need to find how to do this repeatably.
Yeah. You started your consultancy, Renegade Operations. What inspired you to take this step? Because this is like the other end of, after doing RevOps forever, you know, it's like, can I go step out on my own and make a living doing this as a consultant? So how do you leverage your strengths as an operator in this venture?
Yeah. So it's twofold. One, I spent the last 16 years kind of stumbling through, working hard, grinding, and then kind of woke up and I'm like, oh my gosh, here I am. You know, I'm a key of, you know, revenue operations and enablement in a startup. So the first fold was, it was more personal. Like, I wanted to take a step back and understanding like what really brought me joy in my life. And I really do love revenue operations. I love managing people. You know, it all happened so quickly, maybe out of my control, that I wanted to take the time to say, is this something that I'm truly passionate about? I'm good at it, but does that mean that, you know, it's bringing me joy? The second is, I do think that I bring a very unique lens, having that sales enablement and operations background. Me personally, what I've come to realize through that reflection over the last 3 months is that I'm really good at a specific part of revenue operations. And it is that kind of more early stage build and then optimize. Once it gets to scale, you're going to have these different type of revenue operators. And that part is also another reason why I left Tableau. Like, they were good. And we had been acquired by Salesforce. So they had everything kind of lock and step, but I knew that my passion lied in the build phase of it. And I think the value that I can bring in those early stages as a fractional consultant is that you get expertise from all three of those, like three-headed dog, and things that they, I'm like, don't do these mistakes. Like I can come in and say, don't do this. But I also understand how change affects people and that humanizing nature of when you're making changes or processes involving people within the business. I've had change happen to me and I know how that feels as a stakeholder. And so making sure that we are leading with empathy as we are navigating this, I think I can bring a unique lens to that. And that's why, you know, my tagline is dare to operate differently, because we're not just numbers, we are humans at the end of the day. And that's when you really get people to follow you, and that's how fast you can move if you're really focusing on that.
So really the idea of being a fractional or a RevOps person almost dovetails into what I was discussing, where it's like, you want to bring these people in early.
Yeah.
Like before you're at 5 million, don't get to 5 million and then think about RevOps. Bring in somebody maybe even fractionally. Maybe you don't have to hire somebody full time, but you can hire somebody that's done it before on a fractional basis to really serve you and be able to deliver the benefits you would get so that you're not scrambling at 5 million. You're already firing on all cylinders at that point.
Yeah. And I think you're growing so fast as a startup. If you hire for one stage, I'm curious of the amount of people that get hired in those early stages can actually scale throughout the business.
That's
really hard to find someone like that. So there are a lot of mishires happening at the VP and C level because they're coming just in at the moment where that's not potentially their strength. Maybe they've been there or they've done that, but it's not their actual strength. And so I think having a fractional person that can see all three different lenses at a specific phrase can help save you money when you are ready to hire someone full-time, FTE, let's go, and then like start to scale it from there.
I would even argue that having somebody on fractionally, you can also help hire that full-time person, right? Like you could be involved with the hiring process to help make sure that the person that comes on board is going to be that right fit, is going to be that right person to bring that business to where it needs to be.
Yeah. And I wonder how many fractional consultants end up getting hired at a client company because they fall in mold, you know? And that's
right, right.
I know that happens. It's like the long interview.
I can see that.
Yeah.
That's too funny.
Yeah.
So you're looking for a really strong background and enablement and then building SDR teams. What are some of the strategies that you think are really essential for developing a really successful sales and operations team? Like what are the things that you tell clients that are small? You know, hey, these are the kind of the foundational principles of what you're going to need to think about when you're building these teams.
Yeah. It's interesting, the whole BDR landscape over the last 5 years, but then also today. Like, I think that that function is going to monumentally change. But from an enablement operations, and I took on BDRs when our BDR leader left, I look at that function as a process. It is a clear defined process. It is repeatable, and it is the top of funnel activities that are happening. And so when I'm looking at building out an SDR team or supporting an SDR team, especially from operations or enablement, I want to feed insights back into the business that we're seeing from a data perspective and like quick examples of what content is converting customers the most or what are they looking at and feeding that back to our BDR team. Or how can we wormhole the conversation from SDR to AEs so that the customer has an exceptional journey and experience with us and they're not having to repeat themselves? Or what can we feed back? So I think when I'm thinking through the BDR function, it is clear defined process. It is handing them what works and really constantly getting that feedback. You know, we've talked earlier about the speed to context and making sure that our teams have context so that we can qualify or disqualify opportunities. And now this goes full funnel. And so we're also talking about customer insights. We're giving them who to actually reach out to. And so from there, it's not only from a inbound or a demand generation perspective, everyone is demand generation across the funnel, really feeding back this information internally. And the quickest process, whether that is tools, a formula internally or context back to the team to really start to optimize, I think that's where the magic happens between each team.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. you and I kind of agree on the concept of revenue operations owning the customer journey from the minute someone's a lead through to being an ongoing customer. You've done a lot of thought leadership around building those customer journeys. Can you share your thoughts on how companies can effectively map and optimize their particular customer journey, what that looks like, and how RevOps can help?
Yeah, absolutely. So, customer journeys. I honestly look at it as like a science experiment. Like I love it. I think that it comes into the bucket of, okay, we have product market fit, but now we're ready to like go to market. And this is where, as a revenue operations professional, you are cultivating relationships, not across just go to market, but how go to market is actually then integrating into the company, i.e. product, engineering. And so for me, building a customer journey map is twofold. One, it's aligning your stakeholders to make sure that we are optimizing our process internally for data capture, for best-in-class customer experience from the minute that they interact with your brand to their customer advocacy for life. And that's when you want to keep your customers and understanding where that leaky funnel is. And so I have a framework and I'm happy to share it with anyone who is listening, of where you align your stakeholders and you really go through this customer journey mapping session together. And it does take time, but it helps give you a clear picture of how you are servicing your customers and whether that's multiple customer journeys or not. And you do this at compelling events. So, you know, is this a new buyer that we are introducing into the funnel? Has a competitor recently come on the market? Or are we introducing a new product line that's opening up this now idea market fit or a different TAM or SAM, and we need to really identify how we're servicing this. Then as a revenue operator, you're like, haha, I just tricked you into giving me a revenue roadmap. I can go and look at what content we need, feed that back to enablement. I can go and look at what tech and automations we need because of what is taking our team so long. I understand what headcount and roles and responsibilities, and my CRO and I can really kind of cultivate that and where we can find efficiencies. Because at the end of the day, they always talk about this leaky funnel and like, where is revenue leaking out? And so that we can plug that. And each one of these steps helps you identify as a revenue operations leader where you can show up or we can show up and start to help that. Because one leader's leaky funnel is everyone's leaky funnel.
Yeah. If you have the problem, someone else has the problem too.
Yeah. And it's affecting, it's like, your leaky faucet is flooding the entire house. So how can make sure to turn that faucet to where it's not leaky anymore? And that's,
yeah,
I found it really empowering and very humbling to map that. Go-to-market leaders just to have this aha moment of, oh my gosh, the interconnectivity that we have together, I haven't seen it this way before. So,
yeah, I would imagine being a consultant, you're getting a lot of exposure to a lot of tech that's out there right now. Is there any thing in the market? Is there anything in the RevOps world that you see today that's particularly going to be a game changer or something that you see that's kind of like the best kept secret that you think other RevOps people should know about?
You know, I think, and not like a specific company or anything, but there's two things. One, I think the BDR function as it is now is going to change. Way that top of funnel is speaking to our customers. They are coming in way more educated. They want to do their own research. They don't want to talk to anyone. BDR is becoming this thought leader. There are two folds here. One is making sure that you have aspects of your sales process that are available in a very small fractional piece before they get to a salesperson. Case in point, having a, not just like a free trial or whatever, because that also has like a human touch to it, but making sure that you have something like a demo click path on your website to make some people can experience your software or what you are and who you are and the value that you're bringing even before they touch. And there are a ton of companies out there that are click-through demo like click paths of your product that they can provide onto your website. And then that becomes the BDR is helping to identify those kind of key activities that are happening. The second being, and I'm going to go out here and say this because I don't know where this lives within the organization, but I think community is becoming a huge deal. It is not customers anymore. I think top of funnel community is something that is super cool. And I actually just listened to a webinar last week, and they were talking about the importance of really prepping and pulling people together way before you are even a customer of a brand, but building a community. And I remember it was our second top lead generation at Tableau. It was our Tableau Public. It was just like, hey, here's just like a data set and you can like have it for free and you can just like go do the thing. So maybe it's freemium, but we created this community of people and then converting them into customers. So it's a very long tail top of funnel. But from a revenue operations perspective, I do think that those two are really helping to adhere to how people want to buy these days. They want to try you out. They're more brand centric than I think they were a long time ago. And so there's a lot of community in like Common Room. And then there's a lot of like click through demo paths that you can give people what they want to accelerate that sales process.
Yeah, I agree with you on the BDR side. I really think that cold calling is going away. The investment that you have to put into cold calling is so high to get ROI. You have to figure out ways to make that much more effective. And one of the things that I see folks doing is converting their BDR team into being partner development reps, where they're basically like, hey, who are our partners? Where are the relationships that they have? You know, leveraging things like Crossbeam or Reveal, identifying those overlaps, and then saying, hey, partner, you already have a relationship with this prospect I'm trying to get into. Who do you know that would like a meeting? Then you get that warm intro. So you're not doing the cold call. Now it's a warm intro. And then, of course, as the recipient of that, where you're being like, hey, I think you guys might be interested in this company. I know you're a customer of ours, but check these guys out. Well, you're going to be way more
100%
to take that call than that person clearly emailed you or cold called you.
Totally. I mean, I would even see BDRs, and I know some organizations do this, moving to the post funnel. I think having them sit customer success, and that's almost like kind of what you're talking about, but why can't they start to drum up this community and
ritual?
We're starting to try that, but I think that's going to be a big thing.
Yeah. Having BDRs cultivate advocates within your customer base.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Different skill set too.
Yeah. No, that's cool. So last question. So if someone is out there, they're like, wow, Laura's career path was amazing. And man, I'm, you know, just getting like crack at moving from sales to RevOps, or it's something I want to go into. What advice would you give them?
Oh, I love this question. I've had such wonderful community and mentors that have helped me get here. I actually, on my website, I have a free like mentoring booking link that if you want to book like a 30
minutes.
Yeah, if you want to book 30 minutes with me, I'm more than happy to talk about how to kind of crack the code, because everybody's journey is going to be different. Their backgrounds might be different. They might be moving from a completely different discipline, and that's okay. And I think it's marrying like, what do those steps look like? I also have a guide that I've just kind of asynchronously shared with people that have reached out of communities to join, people to follow on LinkedIn, because at the end of the day, self-education, there's so many, I'm in so many Slack channels that it's really hard to do. But there are fantastic communities out there that you can start to absorb these concepts and get to know. Like, I attend probably 2 webinars a week because I love learning and understanding what's top of mind. And then also like leaning on the community. So there are a ton of free communities that offer space for you to ask questions and connect with people. The community one is really, really fun and it's very easy. So I'm happy to offer over those resources and or books to use. And I have a couple of free courses that are kind of crash courses that I've collected to get you kind of up to speed into the RevOps world.
Awesome. Well, Laura, what is your website so people can go there and check it out?
Yeah. So it's just renegadeoperations.com. And then through the booking link, it's just a free 30-minute mentor session. Or you can find me on LinkedIn. It's just my name. My wheels is in there too. But I'm happy, like, send me a private message. I'm happy to connect, share over any resources as possible. I'm in all the communities, so you can probably find me there too. So I'm very happy to help.
Awesome. Well, Laura, thanks for being a guest today on the OpStart podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Don. It was a pleasure.
The OpStart podcast is brought to you by Lean Data. To find out more about us and our suite of Salesforce native products for marketing, sales, and revenue operations, head to leandata.com and then make sure to search for OpStars in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, or anywhere else that podcasts are found. Make sure to click subscribe so you don't miss on any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at OpStars and Lean Data, thanks for listening.